Welcome to the Six Figure Developer Podcast, the podcast where we talk about new and exciting technologies, professional development, clean code, career advancement, and more. I am John Calloway.
I'm Clayton Hunt.
And I'm John Ash.
With us today is Ed Charbonneau. Ed is a Microsoft MVP and an international speaker, writer, online influencer, a developer advocate for progress, and expert on all things web development. Welcome, Ed.
Thanks for having me.
Would you take a moment before we get started, just telling us a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, I've been a professional developer for about 15 years in the web and .NET space. I actually have a degree in electronics engineering, but I always found myself writing software to solve problems in the manufacturing space. And I worked for a company for 15 years doing those type of things. I started with a little bit of VB6 and wrote a little desktop app to do some, paperless work instruction systems. Kind of put myself out of a job. So my boss was like, what are you going to do with the other 35 hours a week now that you have all this stuff in the computer and it kind of keeps itself up to date? And I was like, well, give me something else to do. And he gave me another task to do when I wrote some more software, and it just kept continuing from there. And most of my career, I've been writing ASP.NET, all the various implementations of it. So everything from web forms 1.0 all the way through the current ASP.NET Core and Blazor.
Wow, very cool. So what are you doing these days?
So about 4 years ago, I transitioned my career to work for Progress. You may know them a little bit better as the Telerik brand. Telerik was their own company when I joined, and they were shortly after that purchased by Progress. But they keep the Telerik name around as the brand of tools that people in the .NET and JavaScript universe know and love. Mainly, we make UI components for all of the popular frameworks and even web desktop, WinForms, all those things.
Very nice. And those watching the live stream see that you're wearing a Progress Telerik Blazor shirt.
Yep, we released the Telerik UI for Blazor 1.0 about 3 weeks back, almost a month now. So what that means is we are offering support for the components that we have for this brand new framework that Microsoft has created. We're really excited about it. We think a lot of folks from different parts of the .NET ecosystem are going to gravitate to it because it really is, for one, has a very short learning curve, but it also speaks to, you know, .NET developers because it has a lot of familiar concepts that you find with other .NET technologies like WPF and Silverlight. Web forms and all those platforms kind of have some synergy here.
Cool. So for those who aren't too familiar with it, would you kind of give us a little bit of a synopsis of what Blazor is and kind of what makes it special?
Sure. So I learned about Blazor a year ago at the MVP Summit out in Seattle. So if you're not familiar with the MVP program, there are MVPs or Microsoft most valuable professionals that are worldwide. We all get together once a year at something called the MVP Summit, where we get to talk to engineers and program managers, product team leaders at Microsoft, and offer feedback on roadmaps and things that are upcoming. And a year ago, Steve Sanderson was there with Daniel Roth, and they presented this new framework idea called Blazor. And Blazor is a framework that allows you to write full stack C# web applications, which means we can finally write .NET that runs on the browser. So there's some, for lack of a better term, magic involved there. I'd be happy to go in depth and explain all the bits and pieces. But kind of a generalization, though, is it's a SPA framework similar to React or Angular that runs completely on the .NET stack. And it's underpinned by WebAssembly. And it comes with all of the great things that you would expect from a modern day SPA application framework. So it's got a component model, paging, routing, dependency injection, and all of those sorts of things. And it's, even though it's in preview right now and it's in its early state, it's very feature rich for such a new framework.
So for if this is a SPA like application framework similar to Angular and React, what about MVC or web forms developers? Should they be looking at this as well, or should they stay with MVC and web forms?
So usually my first bit of advice is stick with what you're most productive with, but keep your eye on Blazor because it has a really low learning curve, especially for .NET developers, and they have built some interesting bridges to those technologies that you just mentioned. So web forms developers, you're going to find that there's some similarities between how components work and event bindings work because it has that desktop or MVVM style of development. And I know a lot of web forms developers use an MVP pattern or some sort of MVVM to do their development. And you're going to find a lot of similarities there. So there's no direct path other than to rewrite from the web forms developer perspective. But for the ASP.NET MVC and Razor Pages developers, especially folks that are on ASP.NET Core, you'll find that they've actually put upgrade paths in. So you can use parts of Blazor within those existing ASP.NET Core applications.
Okay, so it doesn't have to be, well, maybe for web forms, but for MVC at least, it doesn't have to be an all or nothing kind of thing. You can kind of bring it in gradually.
Yeah, so for example, with the Telerik UI components that we build, we have a data grid that has sorting, filtering, all those capabilities. You could actually use that data grid inside of an MVC view or Razor Pages with ASP.NET Core, even though it's a Blazor component. So it's really interesting stuff.
And you'll still get all the same, because like the Blazor server side uses SignalR, right?
Yeah, so we should probably get into those bits and pieces first and maybe circle back for those that aren't really familiar with how the framework actually works. It's worth knowing that there's these upgrade paths, and we can talk about them, how they work under the covers in more detail once we kind of educate people on what the framework does to begin with. So I guess maybe I should start there. So there, like you said, there's two different modes of operation that Blazor can run in. The one that I think people are really interested in because it's so new and different is the client-side operation. So you can run .NET code on the web client. So you're actually running C# code within the browser, which is a new area that we haven't been able to experience before. This is thanks to WebAssembly. This is a web standard technology. It doesn't require any plugins or any of those sorts of things like we've seen in the past. It's not a rebirth of Silverlight. it's not any of those sorts of things. So it's any of the evergreen browsers are going to support that. So Chrome, Firefox, Safari all support WebAssembly. And WebAssembly, you have a bytecode that runs in the browser. So you're kind of circumventing JavaScript. It runs in the same sandbox as JavaScript, and you actually need JavaScript to kind of bootstrap your WebAssembly files up and get them running. But you can do a lot of things in WebAssembly that you could possibly also do in JavaScript. If you're running against direct WebAssembly, you can possibly run faster than JavaScript. However, the .NET team's taken a different approach to this. Instead of compiling your code, for example, if you're a C++ developer, you might compile to WebAssembly. In .NET, what we've done instead is we've taken the Mono runtime and compiled the runtime to WebAssembly. So with the runtime running in the browser, we can now just ship standard .NET code to the browser and let it run in the browser natively. So it's a really interesting spin on things as far as WebAssembly is concerned, and it opens up some really interesting possibilities. One of those big possibilities being using existing code that existed pre Blazor and run that in the browser as if it was intended to run there. I can give you a couple examples. Mediator runs in the browser. JSON.NET runs in the browser. I've used Markdig, which is a markdown processing library. All these things were written without Blazor in mind, but they all work there because the runtime is there.
So the mono runtime in WebAssembly, that's the magic that you alluded to previously?
Yep. So the mono runtime, this is the same runtime that that you use for things like the Unity game development platform. So you have AAA first-person shooters and things running on top of the mono runtime in Unity, and those games can be found on the Xbox, PlayStation, Nintendo Switch, all of those things. It's also the same runtime that powers Xamarin. So you've got .NET apps running in iOS and Android. So now they've targeted the browser with the mono runtime, and now we have Blazor, a SPA application framework that runs in the browser.
Okay, and you mentioned that this was the client mode. Mm-hmm. What's the other option?
So there's also a server-side mode to Blazor. So Blazor can run, it runs independently of the UI portion. So it runs out of process. We can attach that UI thread in different ways. So we can run the mono runtime on WebAssembly in the browser. We can ship our .NET code there, and we can run it directly inside the UI thread in the browser. We could also run the application code as a .NET executable on the server. And we can attach the UI thread through a SignalR service that runs in the browser. So now we have a thin client situation where all of our .NET code runs on the browser, or sorry, on the server. And the browser and server stay in sync with an abstraction called a render tree. Now, the render tree exists on WebAssembly as well, but when you're running on WebAssembly, that render tree is handled on the client side. The render tree in the server side scenario, it exists on the server, and the client sends event updates to the server. And it says, hey, you know, the user click this button, and then the server figures out what that change was based on what you clicked on. It sends back down the wire just the changes that the browser needs to update. So if you click a button and it changes, say, an H2 tag, just that H2 tag on the page changes and nothing else. So you're not wiping the entire page out like we would see with, you know, early days web forms with these postbacks and things like that. So it's a much more efficient thin client type of a model.
That's cool. So what about between the two, what's the sort of experience from the user's perspective as far as like page load times? And you kind of also mentioned there's the possibility of the client running an application faster than you would in, say, like native JavaScript. But like, what about like load times and, if you're going over that SignalR?
Yeah, there's some interesting trade-offs between running completely on the client side versus completely on the server side. One thing you get when you're running completely client side is you have the ability to do things like offline mode, where you have, say, a PWA that's built on Blazor, and all of the client side code is there on the device ready to go. And if you happen to lose internet connection, you can still perform certain tasks and then do updates when you reconnect and things like that. It also enables you to offload all of the processing work to the device. So maybe your Azure bill is really large. You could actually ship that code down to the client, make them do the work, and then you don't have to pay for those hours on Azure. A good example of that is try.net. So try.net is part of the .NET docs system. And initially, they wrote try.net so you could write code in your browser in .NET. And it would compile that on the server and run the application code on the server in Azure. And it was running up a huge bill at Microsoft. I don't know what they pay for Azure. I know what we pay. I don't know what they pay. But it was enough for them to take notice and say, if there's a way we can offload some of this processing elsewhere, it'd be nice. So they looked at this new framework called Blazor that their guys were working on internally, and they said, let's give this a shot. So they offloaded all of that work to the client. So now when you write code in try.net, it compiles on the server and then ships the bits back to you and runs them in the browser itself. So there's actually a big use case for that. And it's nice to see Microsoft dogfooding their own work there. So that's some of the upsides to the client-side approach. With the server-side approach, you get to run all of your code on the server. So it gives you some added security around your IP that you're shipping across the wire. With the client-side stuff, you're actually shipping code, compiled code down the wire, which can be decompiled. Let's not kid anybody. .NET code can be reverse engineered very easily. There's this a company named Progress that has a tool that's completely free called Just Decompile. I'm a little familiar with them and what they do. So you could use Just Decompile. You could actually decompile those files. No different than JavaScript that you send down the wire as well. If the client has the code, there's some security concerns that could be had there in any scenario. So that's one of the things. If you're running completely server-side, nobody's going to be able to get any of your code and decompile it. Again, all you're shipping across the wire is these diffs over a WebSocket. So it's a little bit of a binary packet that just contains your updates. So none of your code is accessible in that way. It's also very fast. It has pre-rendering on the server, so you get server-side rendering. So the app is going to boot up a whole lot quicker because it's not waiting for resources to load and get added to the browser and parsed out and whatnot. So it's a lot faster to get up and running from the client's perspective. They're not going to have any type of loading situation there. It's going to be immediate. But when they interact with the application, depending on their latency, they may notice some lag if they've got, say, poor bandwidth or something like that. And then, of course, if it gets disconnected, the application stops responding. You get a page that says that, you know, you've been disconnected from the server. Would you like to retry, type of a thing? This is similar to kind of the way it would happen in Slack. If you use a Slack desktop app and you lose your connection, you know, you get the little retry logic that pops up. So you get that same type of experience in a Blazor app.
Yeah, for the client side scenario, what are the concerns, the security concerns? Because I know, you know, I've been a full stack developer, a JavaScript front end, .NET back end. You know, I'm used to the client receiving essentially the full functioning UI front end web app in JavaScript, but mm-hmm. I know that there's a concern by purely .NET and back end developers that, you know, well, are we really going to ship our entire application to the client? what are the concerns, or what do we need to be aware of in transitioning to that type of model?
So the security concerns with Blazor are identical to those in JavaScript. We're not doing anything that JavaScript can't already do. We're not, just because it's .NET code doesn't mean it has magical access to Windows system resources, registry, those type of things. There's people that are under the assumption they can, just because it's a .NET thing and it's a Microsoft machine, that you're going to be able to get credentials. And those things actually can have some positive benefits. You might want to detect the user that's logged in and stuff like that. Well, if you can't do it in JavaScript, you can't do it in Blazor. It works in the same sandbox as JavaScript. So the trade-offs on that front are exactly the same. As far as shipping code across the wire, client-side JavaScript apps, they ship all of their logic across the wire that you put in a JavaScript file. Same thing goes with a Blazor app. If you're putting sensitive business logic in a DLL that could potentially go across the wire, you might want to put that behind an HTTP call instead. So you might want to put that behind a web API controller and just do a fetch to get the data from it instead of actually running that business logic on the client.
So in JavaScript applications, it's extremely common to uglify your code, and the way that the bundlers behave, they also kind of make the code more difficult to read. Would you suggest that we do something like that with the .NET code? Like, what is it? .fuscator? Would we want to do that for Blazor?
Yeah, that's a potential thing that you could use to help with that situation. I would say by default, you know, if something is sensitive, put it behind an HTTP request first and foremost. But if you have something that's just you don't want people peeking at, then you could obfuscate that code and have some pretty good reliability that they're not going to be able to read it that way. But if you have something that's mission critical, you should probably never, ever send it to the client. This is kind of security basics, is never to trust the client. Always validate and never send them anything you don't want them to have. So I think that goes for no matter what type of platform you're on. And you could somewhat reliably obfuscate JavaScript code. But at the end of the day, if somebody really wanted to get in there and see what it does, they're going to be able to reverse engineer that thing. So it's best to just keep it on the server if that's what you're going to do with it. There's other ways to go around that too. I mean, there's Azure Functions, there's other platforms that offer microservices and things that you could use as well that work both in JavaScript and in Blazor.
So I know when we talked to Daniel Roth, I think it was like several months ago, 6 months ago, something like that. Blazor was definitely in a very experimental state at Microsoft, but I understand that's changing or has changed. Do you have any idea what the status of Blazor is and where, when we can expect it to be sort of fully backed and released?
When will it become a real boy? I was at Build, and I have a podcast called Eat Sleep Code, and I had Dan on my podcast as well for the Build event. And we talked about this a little bit on the show. And what's happened is they've taken the experimental tag off of Blazor. That's officially been removed as of the last release. So preview 5 is what we're at now. And Blazor's now in the preview mode. So you'll notice that it has the preview release version numbers and everything that coincide with ASP.NET Core proper. So it's tightly aligned with the release of ASP.NET Core 3.0. So when 3.0 ships, we will have official support for server-side Blazor. The client side is going to continue in preview mode for some time being, and Dan estimates that Q1 is a possible scenario for shipping client-side Blazor. Now, that's nothing official, nothing written in stone, but that's his, gut feeling is Q1 looks like a good opportunity to possibly release that. So it's getting close to being both the server and client are getting close. We'll have the server side in, I believe it was September, was the GA release of ASP.NET Core 3.0. And then it should be several months before we see the client side fully fleshed out. We've got, there's some drawbacks currently to the client side that I haven't talked about yet that they're working on the ASP.NET team. When we're compiling .NET libraries to ship those across the wire, they are still generally large in size. So their client-side code is going to be a little bit on the bloated side. Hello World app right now is running about 2.1 meg. So that's a little on the large side. JavaScript has these same type of issues. Angular and React apps can get quite large as well. So they're not alone there, but at least they're committed to fixing that and making it as lightweight as possible. So they have a technology in Mono called the IL Linker. And this is, again, used on the other platforms that they have, iOS and Android with Xamarin, things like that. What it does, it's essentially tree shaking for .NET. So if you're familiar with tree shaking in JavaScript, it's a similar idea where it analyzes your code, figures out what paths you're not using, and kind of ejects those from the compiled code base. So you're not going to ship unneeded code across the wire. Another thing that they're working on is AOT compilation. So Blazor is going to be one of the first technologies to use the Mono AOT parts of the framework. And what that will allow you to do is actually ahead of time compile the code directly to WebAssembly as needed. So portions of your code may become WebAssembly, and that may make them run faster. It may change the file size, and those things can go in either direction. Actually, they've got some tooling that's going to need to be written to analyze whether AOT is making it larger or smaller, what the trade-off performance is going to be. So those things are getting worked on, and that's what's taking the client side longer to ship an official 1.0, is they're working on those problems, because they're, they're pretty big problems, and they want to make sure that when it's 1.0, it's something that people can use reliably and not have these type of things happening. And I'd rather wait, the extra time and have it work right, rather than them ship it early and get a kind of a bad reputation for being either slow or file sizes being huge or those type of things, right?
So I have I've been playing with Blazor when I can, and at work we have found a couple things that that we've put on our list of things that are required before we can start using Blazor. We'll probably use it before it's officially released, but only on our back office applications. So if they break, it's not the end of the world. But one of the big things that surprised me, and it's not even Blazor's fault, but Mono didn't have support for time zone offsets.
Interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. So like we could, because you know how in the browser, it's central time, or, like it just uses local time, and then you've got to convert that to UTC and then send it up, or, whatever. And we couldn't do that with Blazor. We were trying to have something launch at exactly 3:05 on everyone's computer, and we couldn't figure out when 3:05 was.
Sounds very suspicious. I don't know. I don't know if I condone what you're trying to do, but no. So if you want to have pop-up ads at 3:05, no, just kidding. I believe that localization is on the issues list. It's on the roadmap for one of the next few releases. I think there's three more previews before it's released. I'm trying to remember. It's been a while since I've looked at the roadmap, but I believe that roadmap is for all of Blazor. So I don't know if it's going to coincide with the server side stuff shipping, where you wouldn't have that issue, by the way. But with the client side, they are working in localization as part of the framework itself. And that's something that Telerik is looking very closely into, because we support localization and accessibility and all of those things in our tooling. And we want to make sure that we wait for them to bake it into the framework before we start putting it in our UI components, because we don't want to come up with a solution that is different than theirs and then have people having to learn two different ways to tackle localization. We did the same thing with validation. So all of our components are written in native Blazor framework code. So they're all written in .NET. We follow the guidelines that Dan's team puts out as far as what they do with validation and things like that. So we waited for them to bake in validation before we added it to our UI components. So now when you use a Telerik UI component on the page, validation just happens automatically, just like it would with any other component in the Blazor framework. So we'll wait for them to put out localization as well, and then we'll bake that in. So if you need right to left support, things like that, and we can detect the globalization namespace. I can't remember what it is off the top of my head, but we can detect that and adjust accordingly.
One of the other things is routing. I know that they've said that they were going to make some more changes to routing, but I haven't seen what those changes are. One of the things that we do with our Angular applications is we'll have a sub application. So we have we're at page one, and then page one has a sub route or a collection of sub routes. And that collection basically makes up its own SPA that we can break off and put into a different repository or copy and paste into another application. And with Blazor, as it sits right now, all of the routes are all the way from the base. Like, you have to have the exact route. Have you heard if that's something that they're looking at changing for the routing or enhancing or allowing?
So what you're describing sounds similar to areas in MVC. Maybe I heard that right, or I haven't really experienced that in Angular. I don't do a lot of Angular apps, but I don't know the specifics around how they may handle that. I do know they have a base path setting in an app, so you can offset the base. So if you're hosting on a subdomain, things like that, you can correct the path there. As far as setting up different types of routing for different parts of the application, that I haven't heard of yet. It may be in the roadmap. I'm not aware. I do know they are making some changes, though, to make the routing to where it is not going to be magic strings anymore. So you'll have routing that's class-based. You'll get strongly typed routing. You'll be able to generate routes and get those. But I haven't heard anything specific to what you were saying.
Okay, well, maybe the programmatic routing might fix it. And then similar but not similar, and you kind of alluded to it with the base path. We deployed a Blazor app to our back office CMS, and all the Blazor files were stored on a CDN, and we had to go into the framework JS file and a data JSON file and manually change all the pathing so that we would be at the correct base path and at the correct CDN path. I think I found a solution for that, but I'm not sure. Do you know of a way to be able to do that?
Other than the base path setting, I'm not sure I've seen that crop up before. I haven't really deployed the applications anywhere important. So I haven't run into that. I haven't noticed the CDN issue that you're talking about either. So I think I'd have to see it to kind of understand how it's being resolved and try to tinker with it a little bit. I know there's some settings that can be tweaked in there, but I'm not sure if they fit your scenario or not.
Okay. The setting I found was the content path setting, but I'm not sure if that's just like images or if it's actually the DLLs. So I'll have to play with it. But if anyone out there is experiencing the same problem and finds the solution, please write a blog post.
Yeah, I know there's some stuff in there that's somewhat hard-coded still. There's some automatically registered JavaScript files and things that are like the Mono Bootstrapper and stuff. And I think the only thing you can control is that base path routing. Like I said, if you're on a subdomain, you can tell it, you know, where, like, for example, I have one out there called Blazedown, which is a markdown editor that runs in the browser, and I'm hosting that on GitHub Pages. And I also have a domain on GitHub, so I had to fool around with the base path on that to get it to work properly. But, you know, those things are possible, but it's very rudimentary kind of dials at the moment. So I think filing issues on these things would be the best way to have them resolved, especially for people that are out there listening that may run into similar things down the road. That way the team can actually see what issues you're having and either offer a solution for it or bake something to the framework to fix it.
Excellent. To go in another direction, one of the things we ask all of our guests is to sort of provide a little bit of feedback or advice, words of wisdom to people who maybe are just getting started. If you think back to when you just got started and you know, what would you have told yourself? What kind of words of wisdom can you share with those folks?
I think one of the best things I can offer to people is remember that it's still in preview. So this is software that's still going through some changes. Some of those are going to be growing pains. You know, you might write some code, and it may be there may be breaking changes on that that, you know, you upgrade and your code might not work anymore. There's also going to be things just fail on you. I mean, it's they use the term preview now, which I guess you could equate to beta. So it's beta software, and things just break, builds hang. It's a lot less frequent now because, you know, we're getting along further in the previews and there's only a couple more left before server-side Blazor is official. So these things are slowly winding down. But in the earlier days, like 2.3.0, these were really frequent occurrences, and it was kind of frustrating. But you have to remember, like, this isn't officially supported yet. You know, it's beta software at best, and you're trying to fit a square peg in a round hole sometimes because it's brand new idea. I mean, there's a lot of things that haven't been tried yet. You may take some existing .NET libraries and try to run them on WebAssembly, and like Clayton said, you know, certain date time features might not be there, and you know, these are just things we have to kind of work through and figure out. It's kind of the Wild West at the moment. But it's also fun. You get to try new things out. And I've seen some really crazy examples. I have a Twitch show that I do that falls under my name, but the name of the show is State Has Changed, which is a method that is, it's named after a method in Blazor that you call when you want to update the browser's or update a component state. So it, you know, it kind of follows along with all of the frequent changes that are constantly happening with this brand new framework. And I frequently get in touch with the Blazor community, and there's a couple guys out there that just build like these bonkers ideas and try to push the envelope as far as they can. And you know, some of this stuff doesn't have practical use, but it's still just fascinating. Like one of them had a cursor that had like a particle generator that was spitting out like rainbows and stuff as you like mouse around the surface. There's been a lot of crazy like canvas related things that people have built, and they're trying to do it with minimal amounts of JavaScript. So that, you know, 99% of the app is written in C sharp and it's able to do all this crazy stuff. And they're constantly breaking things along the way, which, you know, it's probably painful for them, but they're also feeding back all of this information to the .NET team. And even though, you know, these are edge case things, they're finding, you know, when I'm animating, you know, rainbow colored pixels flying out of my cursor, I've run into this issue. It's really bizarre stuff, but being in close in touch with the community through the Twitch show has been a lot of fun. And there's some really brilliant people out there that really like to kick the tires on this thing. So
along with your Twitch show, what other resources might you point people to?
Sure. So I've got the podcast I mentioned called Eat Sleep Code, where I interview developers all the time. I had Daniel Roth on there. We also crossed over with the live stream on my Twitch show with that. And then blogs.telerik.com is where I put my personal blogs for Blazor, and edcharbonneau.com is my personal website that I kind of link off to various resources on as well. But blazor.net is the official Microsoft resource. And then the community members are fantastic as well. Chris Santy's one of them. He frequently blogs about Blazor, so chrissanty.com. There's really a very active community right now. So there, if you go to, gosh, I can't remember the exact URL for it because it's changed quite a bit since they moved the GitHub repo. There's a Gitter channel. I'll have to send you guys a link for your show notes for it. But the Gitter channel is very popular. And that's where all the community members come in and kind of talk about what they're building and what issues they're having and stuff, and try to help each other out or show off some cool thing they're working on. And that's one of the most useful resources that's out there.
Awesome. Awesome. And if people want to maybe follow you, what social media accounts can you plug, and maybe upcoming speaking engagements would you like to?
Sure. So I I guess we've got some live viewers. So I will be at Beer City Code teaching a Blazor workshop on May 31st. I also have a session the next day on June 1st about Razor and all the various implementations of Razor over the years. So I'll be at Beer City Code. That's in Grand Rapids, Michigan. And then as far as social media, very frequently on Twitter, I go by my name everywhere. So if you can spell Ed Charbonneau, you can find me. If you can't spell it, you can go to Blazor Videos or blazorpro.com and you will find me through one of those URLs. They're just forwarding to either my website or my videos that I do. So that's how you can find me the easiest.
All right, Ed, thanks so much for coming on.
Thanks for your time. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
That was Ed Charbonneau. Ed is Microsoft MVP and an international speaker, writer, online influencer, developer advocate for progress, and expert on all things web development. Ed enjoys geeking out to cool new tech, brainstorming about future technology, and admiring great design.
If you like this episode, please like, rate, and review on iTunes.
Find show notes, blog posts, and more at sixfiguredev.com.
And be sure to follow us on Twitter at sixfiguredev.
This has been another episode of the Six Figure Developer Podcast, helping others reach their potential. I am John Calloway.
I'm Clayton Hunt.
And I'm John Ash.